try again. Everybody knows that the Torah forbids one Jew loaning another Jew with interest, right? That's one of the basic building blocks. The problem is that in modern day society especially, that is a particularly untenable law for people to live by, because in the old days when our society was agricultural, so relatively small sums of money were needed, and loans were generally of relatively small sums, and the money could be more or less handed over with ease and gotten back a short while later. Nowadays, of course, when our society is much more capitalistic and speculative, and larger sums of money are needed, it's not so easy for people to part with sums of money in the order of those which are needed for investment for large periods of time and not get money in return. And therefore, of course, it's necessary to have interest in order to pay the person for the money which is being lent. And of course, there are things like mortgages where it's impossible to get the amount of money which is necessary to buy a house unless one pays interest on the amount which one borrows. So the question is, how do we get around the fact that the Torah quite explicitly tells us that you're not allowed to take interest from another Jew? A, in the situation of a commercial loan such as a bank, and B, in the situation of a personal loan. Very often it happens that one Jew wants to lend another Jew money, and that for reasons, whether they have to do with business or with the question of a large sum which he has to give over for a long period of time, one Jew wants to give another Jew a personal loan, but he wants to receive interest for that loan. The question is there any legal loophole which is to be found which enables one to loan money to one's fellow Jew at interest? Now, it's interesting that until approximately the 16th century or 17th century, there was no such concept as heter iska. Nobody had come around with an official legal loophole to do this. I want you to keep in mind during the course of the evening that a heter iska is very similar to the concept of, which one can you think of, another famous legal loophole? Better yet, mechiras chametz. In other words, mechiras chametz also is not alluded to at all in the Gemara. It's a later invention which came about because as society became more complex, it became prohibitively expensive to part with one's chametz each and every year at Pesach time altogether. So therefore, several legal loopholes were built into the system, one of which is mechiras chametz, another of which is heter iska. What does heter iska mean? The word iska itself means a business deal, a transaction, okay? What we are saying is that in instituting this legal loophole, we are creating a mechanism which will allow us to view a loan, instead of as a loan, as a business transaction. The question is, what kind of business transaction are we viewing it as, and why does this viewing the transaction as a business, as opposed to a loan, make it permissible? So the answer is we have two possibilities in Shulchan Aruch. One of them is here on page 1 in Simen Kuf Samach Zayin. And this is a very interesting halacha. Let's read inside. Malva Odom L'Chavero Mone. I'm allowed to lend my friend $100. Al Tznai on the condition. Sheis Asik Bo. That my friend should do business with that $100. In other words, I'm making my agent. I give him $100 and say, here, this is a loan. You are my agent now to take this money which I lent you and do business with it. Until instead of $100, you get $200. The catch is, catch number one, that if the Lova loses the money, the Malva has to consider right off the sum. If the Lova, the borrower, let's get those terms straight. Malva is a lender. Lova is a borrower. If the Malva, the lender, wants the Lova, the borrower, to do a business with the deal of money, he has to be willing to lose all the money in the event the transaction goes sour. Okay? Then, via b'chayis ha-malva doso zman, the lender retains the responsibility for the loss. And when it comes out to be $200, then the $200 can go back to the lender. And from there on in, let's say there's some money left invested in the business, or in the stocks or in the bonds, whatever the borrower invested in with the money, then the loaveh continues to get, the borrower continues to get whatever profits come in. Ubilvat, as long, sheyitein tschar amolo, that the lender gives the borrower a commission on the money, on the work which he's doing for him as his agent, ad shushnei monim, until it gets up to those $200. V'im hitnoi mo mitchila, if originally they made a condition that the commission will be symbolic, afilu b'choshu, even a dollar, shehit no lost his lo b'schar amolo, that's what he's giving him as his commission, sagi, that's sufficient. Now, we see here very interesting, halacha, I'm going to recapitulate outside. We see here, normally, the halacha is, let's say I give you a $100 loan, and you lose those $100. You got to repay me anyway, because whatever you do with the loan is your business. You owe me money, I don't care, you might can lose the money, can get burnt up. Lamaisa, now, whenever the due date comes, you have to pay me back $100. That's in a normal loan. In that case, if I attach in a normal loan a condition that when you give me back the money, you have to pay me an additional $100, that's considered to be interest. That's what the Torah forbade. The Torah said, I can't attach a condition to a loan that besides the $100 which I lend you, which you must pay back to me, that you have to pay back to me more money. That is classic loan plus interest. Torah forbade that between two Jews. Here, however, there's a different scenario. And what's crucial here is two things. A, the lender is making the borrower an agent on a sum which remains the responsibility of the lender. By that we mean that if the money is lost in some deal, or if the money is burnt, or if the borrower went and spent the money in a way which was even negligent, perhaps, we'll see that later on. In so those cases, the lender is stuck. He doesn't get back a red cent. Stuck. Finished. There's another important condition here, that in order to make sure that this is exactly what it seems to be, the lender has to pay the borrower a symbolic sum. It can be a dollar, but he has to pay him a symbolic sum for acting as his agent and on his behalf. Okay? Those are the two conditions which are involved here, and that's what makes this permissible. That's one type of iska. Let's see another type of iska. Let's turn the page.
Because you have to give the money away at those nine. You were supposed to pay
You have to give the money
away, so to say, so it's not yours. Whatever happens to it, it's gone.
Whatever happens to it, it's gone, right? Plus you're paying the guy. Yeah, we're going to see for obvious reasons that this is not considered to be very advantageous to the lender, right? Okay, now, the next possibility is completely different. Not completely different, somewhat different. Hanosi Mos Chaver, here on page 2, in the text in the middle. Hanos, this is from the Shulchan Aruch. Hanosi Mos Chaveru, someone who gives money to his friend, Bekores Iska, as a business transaction. But the Hainu, here, this is the way it works. Half of the responsibility is on the lender, and half the responsibility on the borrower, also. That's forbidden. Okay? Now, this is a case like this. I give you a loan of $100, and I say, I take the responsibility of $50, and you take the responsibility of $50. That's forbidden. Why? He explains. Shekol iska pal gamilva pal gapikadon. In this case, the way I look at it is that the $50, which I say is your responsibility, is a loan to you. And the $50, which I say is my responsibility, is still my sum, which I gave over to you for safekeeping, which is called in Hebrew a pikadon. What do I mean by pikadon? I gave you the sum for safekeeping, for investment, whatever purpose, it's still mine. That's why if it gets lost or damaged or destroyed, I'm the one who suffers the loss and not you, right? In this case, what's happening is, v'nimtso shetoreach b'chelak ha-pikadon, what's happening in essence is that you, the borrower, are investing my $50, which is the pikadon, as a payment to me for having given you $50 as a loan, right? Is that clear? Again, I'll repeat it. First, let's read it inside. We find that the borrower is toiling with the part which is given as a pikadon, as a deposit, let's call it in English, because of the part which is given as a loan. Again, I'm lending you $100. I say, I'm taking, retaining for myself the responsibility for 50%, and I'm giving you the responsibility for 50%. In essence, what I'm saying in this case is that 50% of this is now a deposit given to you for safekeeping, for which if there's a loss, I suffer the loss. 50% of this is now a loan, for which if there's a loss, you suffer the loss. You have to pay me back nonetheless. In this case, what's happening? Why is this forbidden? Because why is the borrower going to go in this case and invest and work for me in the 50% which I retained as my as a deposit by him, the picadon, as in gratitude or in payment for the fact that I gave him a loan of $50? So in essence, the work which he's doing for me in the $50, which is a deposit, is a payment of interest on the loan which I gave him, and that's forbidden. And I want to tell you, just like you're not allowed to loan somebody money with interest, you're not allowed to loan somebody money and tell them, since I gave you a loan, go to the store and buy me a newspaper. Understand? That's also a form of interest. To go and ask somebody to buy you a newspaper because I gave you money, because somebody get to go is a form of interest, just like monetary payment is. And here, that's what's happening. So how do I get around it here? How can I possibly get around this problem? Very simple. Says Shukrach, Lefichach tzarech lo litain schar tircho. Therefore, I have to give him a commission. The lender has to give the borrower a commission. Shebechol yom v'yom yimei shutfus. Every day that there's a partnership. Kipoel batar shosam lach. I have to give him money, which he would receive as somebody who worked in this type of agency. Shebatam yimei. I'm not going to go into those parameters. It's complex. And then he goes on to say that v'ima yolo esek acher, if the borrower had some other type of business from which he was making a livelihood, koshu of any sort, lisasikbo, with which he was dealing, ima also shows at the same time that he was dealing with the money which he was given, enotzorech lalos lo schar shel koyom, I don't have to give him a daily payment, elafilu helo dinar b'chol yimei ha-shutfus, even if I'm giving a symbolic payment of a dollar for the entire partnership, dayo, it's sufficient. And therefore, if the money goes up or down in value, you ba'emtza b'shaveh, we split the profits or the loss 50-50. Why? Because since you're my agent on 50%, and 50% is yours, so therefore the profits or losses are shared by us equally. Fair is fair, right? These are two types of business transactions. To sum up the difference, the first one remained completely in the responsibility of the lender. And what happened is that he said that you go out, make money, and whatever money you make, up to $200, I want back. Whatever's beyond $200, you get to keep. That was the first case. In that case, the lender was completely responsible and completely at risk. In the second case, the lender's only 50% at risk, right? Because 50% of the money is a loan, for which he's not at risk at all, because the borrower has to pay back regardless. 50% is only a deposit, for which the lender only pays back, the borrower only pays back, if in fact the money's still around. If the money gets lost, tough luck on the lender. In this second case, whatever profits they are, or losses, are split 50-50. Why they split 50-50? Because they're 50-50 partners in whatever deal is going to be transacted. The guy who got the loan, that 50% of the money, as long as he doesn't pay it back, is his. So he's a 50% partner, whatever transactions will be done with this money.
Are you saying that no profits are attributed to the loan?
No profits are attributed to the picadon? No, the profits are attributed 50-50 in the second case or the first case?
The second case
is 50-50. That's right. So the 50%, which is a loan, those profits go to the borrower. Because once he borrowed the money, it's his money. And the 50%, which is a deposit, that money goes to the lender because that money remains the lender's money. It's as if, listen, it's very simple. It's as if the two of us came and deposited $100 at a bank account. I deposit 50, you deposit 50. So we split the profits or losses. The same thing here. Even though all the money originally came from the lender, but since when the borrower receives 50% of that, he received 50% as a loan in halacha. Once you get a loan, that's your money until you pay it back. So therefore, whatever profits are realized from that go to the borrower. the 50%, which is a pikadon, which is a deposit, those profits from that 50% go to the lender. Are we clear on these two types of situations?
So it's not completely his. He's splitting it.
You're splitting it, that's right.
Gains and losses, but it's not completely going back.
That's right, it's not completely going back.
Well, the 50% is not really a loan, it's a gift.
Which 50%? There's no gift here.
Loan. He has to return it.
He has to return it, yeah.
Or just the principal, not no interest.
Yeah, of course. There's no you're not allowed to pay interest in halacha, right? Okay, now, so the thing, the both these cases evolved into what we call a heter iska in two steps. The first type of heter iska was based on the first halacha, where, again, the lender gave all the money to the borrower as a loan, but the lender retained the risk. If the money gets lost, he loses it altogether. And that was the most basic type of heter iska. What happened would be that two people get together, the lender, one Jew, would say to the borrower, another Jew, here's $100, I'm willing to accept the loss, go, you work, and you pay, you go, you make money, I get the profits up to a certain point, beyond that you get the profits. The thing is, there were several problems with this. The first problem is, of course, that, yeah, so now the lender's taking a big risk. If there's a loss, what's he going to do? He loses everything, loses his shirt. The second problem is more complex, we'll come to it in a minute. So what do they do in order to prevent that first problem? What they did in order to the first problem is they made a very ingenious device. They said, you know what? The love is only believed, the borrower is only believed to say he lost the money if he can produce two witnesses. The rabbi of the congregation, generally they said the rabbi of the congregation and the chazan, specifically those two, who can testify with certainty that the principal is lost. Now that's a very good safeguard for the lender, because normally the rabbi and chazan of the congregation have no idea what's flying. They can't testify. So therefore, the borrower is never able to produce valid testimony based on the conditions which were meted out that he lost the money. This is a great safeguard for the lender. Is that clear? True. This is a loophole. Bear in mind that we're dealing with a legal loophole here before you ask any questions, because obviously there are going to be some sleight of hand things here. Okay, so what's happening here is, again, that the lender is saying to the borrower, true, I accept upon myself the risk. If there's a loss, then I accept upon myself the loss, but you got to prove it. How do you prove you had a loss? Only by producing the rabbi and the chazan of the kehila to say that there was a loss.
Where's there a precedent?
There is no precedent for that.
No precedent.
But it's a condition. You can make any condition you want in a business transaction. So this is a condition. This is the tnai, the condition which they made in the loan. Now, what else did they do? How do we know, let's say the guy comes, or the borrower comes and says, okay, you're right, I didn't lose the principal. I can't prove to you I lost the principal. I didn't make any profit. And you can't require me to bring witnesses. I didn't make any profit. That's an impossibility. How's anybody going to know what profit I made? Witnesses are not possible in such a scenario. Nobody's going to be able to know. So what could they do to safeguard against the borrower coming and saying, I didn't make any profit. There's nothing for me to return to you except for the principal itself. They can't do that because witnesses can, you can use the vehicle witnesses on an amount which already existed. And you, in other words, the borrower has to produce witnesses that principal vanished into thin air, right? And that, but you cannot have witnesses, tangible witnesses, demand witnesses on something which didn't yet exist to see whether it got lost. I don't know if I'm expressing myself well. The lender can demand witnesses to say that something which existed no longer exists. But the lender cannot demand witnesses to say that something which the Lovik claim was not produced was actually produced. How can you have witnesses on something like that? It's not possible to say, no, you're only believed to say you had no profit if you produce witnesses. What do witnesses testify? That they didn't see the process of making profit? That they saw the process of making profit? That's not logical. We can't require witnesses on that step. So what they required on that step... Yeah?
You can't trust witnesses to say that he lost the money. I mean, how do they know
what?
He lost the money? On the first instance.
Yeah.
On the principle.
No, I trust witnesses to say they lost the money. I trust witnesses to say he lost the money in the first step. It's just they have to be the best witnesses in the community. That's why I need the rabbi and the chazan.
Yeah, but how do they? How can they actually know that he lost money?
Unless they a fire. They saw a fire in his house and all the money burnt up in smoke. They saw he went off to sea and his ship drowned. Those are things they can actually testify, events which they can testify on. The making of the prophet is not an event. It's not possible to testify on that. Okay, so what did they do in that case? They said, in order for the, they wrote a condition into the loan, and they said, in order for the borrower to be believed that he didn't make any money, he has to come to a shul and hold a Sefer Torah and take an oath, a solemn oath, that he didn't make any money. And most Jews are afraid to make such oaths. In the old days, at least, they were. So a Jew wouldn't come to shul and take an oath and Sefer Torah, you know, with the rabbi and the community around, and say that he didn't make any money, unless he really didn't make any money. So the odds are that the guy is not going to lie about that. But there were two problems involved with this, and let's turn now to page 3. What's the second problem? On the bottom of the left hand column. In terms of making capital available for commercial purposes, an obvious deficiency with regard to this arrangement is that the interest received by the lender is not tied to the period of time its capital is used by the borrower. What does the lender say? He says, here's $100. When you get another $100, give it back to me. Give me $200. You're my agent. Make me $200. Interest cannot accrue over time in that case. There's a specific amount which is requested back from the borrower. Interest doesn't accrue over time, right? Again, in terms of making capital available for commercial purposes, an obvious deficiency with regard to this arrangement is that the interest received by the lender, interest in quotation marks, is not tied to the period of time as capital is used by the borrower and does not provide for accrual of additional interest in the event that repayment is delayed. Therefore, subsequently, a modified form of the Heter Iska was developed, which had the effects of eliminating this difficulty, which is the second type. Under the terms of this modified Heter Iska, the recipient accepts 50% of the funds as a deposit, that's the pikadon, and 50% as a loan, that's the halva. Any expenditure of commercial or investment nature is deemed to be a joint return in which both parties share equally. Thus, technically, half the profits accrue to the principal, and which is the lender in this case, and half to the borrower. The principal, of course, may of course agree to accept no more than a certain stipulated amount of the profits, and the agent may demand that the agreement specify the profits exceeding that amount accrue to the agent as compensation for his services. It's a brilliant loophole. What happens is like this. Now, what are we going to do? I want to lend you $1,000. It's up to $1,000. And I say, listen, I want to make, I'm very bad at these figures. I want to make 10% interest, right? Every year you don't pay me back, let's make it easy. I want to get $120 a year. Every month you don't pay back, I want $10 interest, right? $10 interest for each month. How are they going to do that? But the writing in the document is like this. 50% of the $1,000, $500 is a loan. 50% of the $1,000, $500 is a deposit. Now, I, the borrower, let's say I'm the borrower in this case, accept upon myself to go out and work with this money. I'm going to go out and work with this money, and I'm going to ensure a certain return. I'm going to ensure a return double $10 a month. I'm going to ensure that there's going to be a return of $20 a month. And that, I'm going to divide up with you 50-50. Just like I'm working with my 50% and your 50%, we're going to divide it up. $10 to me, $10 to you. I specify that if there's more than $20 profit, I get to keep the excess. Which is fine. That's okay. I can specify that whatever excess there is goes to me, as long as I provide you with what you wanted for your picado. So what's happening here is very interesting. There's interest accruing every month. But all that interest is accruing as far as the lender is concerned to his 50%, which is a deposit. Why? Because we created a legal fiction of $20 profit every month. since we created this legal fiction of $20 profit every month, $10 of that is going to the borrower and $10 is going to the lender. This is fictitious. There might not be $20 of profit. There might not be any profit whatsoever. But it's worth it to me to pay you those $10 a month to get out of having to provide the witnesses and taking the oath. Okay? In other words, what I'm saying is, I am so getting out. Now, here's a very interesting thing. I'm not paying interest. No interest here at all. What I'm doing is, in order to get out of the oath and testimony, and in order to show, to demonstrate that I was a viable agent, I'm giving you that money. And what I actually did with my 50% and your 50%, whether I spent it into business or whether I didn't spend in business, is immaterial to you. As long as you get your return, you don't demand an oath from me. You don't demand the witnesses from me. In essence, what I'm paying for is the right not to provide witnesses or an oath. I'm not paying interest on a loan. It's an amazing thing. Let's see, you know, I'm going to skip and show you a heter iska. Nice, simple one. Let's turn to page 8. Later on, we'll see more complicated ones. This is almost a literal translation from Kitzur Shulchan Aruch on the left-hand side. Our signature below shall act as 100 valid and credible witnesses how the business that we purchased from so-and-so, whose address is so-and-so, on August 11th so-and-so, for the amount of $60,000, and we are obligated to do with them, the monies, a partnership part by part, whether for profit and for loss. And specifically regarding the principle mentioned above, we will not be believed to say we lost it, or we repaid it fully or partially, but only with an awesome and stringent oath sworn with a Torah scroll in an Orthodox synagogue in front of the congregation at the time of the reading of the Torah and with two select and credible and established witnesses. Nevertheless, it is agreed between us that if we, the signatories below, do not want to swear as mentioned above, then we agree to pay to the seller mentioned above 8.75% per year profit on the amount of principal in our possession, according to the specified schedule in the English language contract done by the attorneys for about this agreement, and we will be exempted from an oath, and there will be not any complaints against us, even if it is clear that the profits are much more. I acknowledge having received $1 for remuneration for my labor. Okay? Now, this is very simple and oversimplified. It's not 100% valid, at least the way I understand the matter of heter iska. But this is would be almost a standard agreement, very basic agreement. We'll see a better one a little bit later in the evening. Now, let's turn back to, by the way, I have to give Mitch Morgenstern credit for providing me with these copies of various different types of heter iskas. Yeah. The oath? The oath is made by the borrower. It's very confusing. That paragraph... You're right. That's why I'm saying it's a mishmash. I'll show you a little bit later in the evening exactly how it... You know what? Let's do it now. Let's turn now to page 6. I mean 7. 6. Now, this is the optimum heter iska. You can see that by the fact that it's very long. It takes up 3 columns on this page. But the thing on the bottom is something else, which we'll have time to get to later on. But Rabbi Bleich, who put this together, gave everybody a very good suggestion. He said, you know what? You don't have to write a heter iska every time. All you have to write is whenever you want to make a loan, that this loan is made in accordance with the text written in Contemporary Halachic Problems, pages 386 to 387. And that way, you don't have to write out the whole document every time. You can just write that it's done in accordance with this form, and that's perfectly fine. Okay, now there's a lot of legalese in here. But the agreement was made this day of so-and-so by and between so-and-so hereafter known as the party of the first part and so-and-so hereafter known as party of the second part. Whereas the party of the second part is desirous of engaging in a commercial enterprise, not a loan, right? And or in acquisitions of bonds and securities, and whereas he lacks sufficient personal funds for this purpose, and whereas the party of the first part is desirous of granting a loan to the party of the second part for this purpose, And whereas the party of the first part is desirous of engaging in a similar commercial enterprise and or acquisition of bonds and securities, and whereas as Jews both parties are bound by religious prohibitions against usury, which prevent them from seeking or granting an interest-bearing loan, see how we've set it up? Beautifully. It's not a loan. It's a commercial investment. So now, therefore, it is agreed as follows. The party of the second part hereby acknowledges receipt of the sum of X dollars from the party of the first part. The party of the second part has accepted the sum of X dollars representing 50% of the total sum received from the party of the first part to be held and invested together with all fruits thereof on behalf of the party of the first part. That's the deposit, the picado. The party of the second part shall invest this sum and all fruits thereof in a prudent and advantageous manner on behalf of the party of the first part in real estate, merchandise, commercial paper, stock, bonds, commodities, or other lawful venture, provided the opportunity for lawful and prudent investment presents itself. Title to all objects of value acquired in this manner of all and of all the fruits thereof shall be vested in the party of the first part. Okay, that is the picado. Yeah. You can't make agreement to go with Las Vegas money, and we'll get to that. Very important. That's a good question, whether you can use a heter isca for a personal expenditure. Very good. The party of the second part has accepted the sum of X dollars representing 50% of the total sum transferred to him. This is the other 50% as an interest-free loan. No interest. The party of the second part shall have the right to commingle his funds with those accepted on behalf of the party of the first part to the extent that the party of the second part and the party of the first part shall each have equal proprietary interest in any purchase or investment. The party of the second part hereby obligates himself to utilize the funds transferred. Any purchase of a mercantile nature or investment made by the party of the second part up to the limit of the sum transferred shall be deemed to have made with these funds. In other words, no matter what the money is used for, it's being used for this commercial transaction. The party of the second part shall receive from the party of the first part the sum of $1 per month until the termination of this agreement as compensation for his services as the agent of the party of the first part. All remaining profits shall be divided equally between the parties. All losses shall be borne equally by both parties. Which means if in fact there's a loss, tough luck. However, the party of the second part shall be obligated to place any unexpended funds in a safe deposit box in a chartered commercial bank and to maintain any merchandise, stock certificates or bonds acquired with these funds in his personal possession at all times. The party of the second part obligates himself to indemnify the party of the first part for any losses sustained as a result of the failure to meticulously discharge this obligation. Fulfillment of this obligation is to be substantiated only on the basis of the testimony of two persons qualified to offer testimony. Such qualification is to be understood as meaning qualification in accordance with Jewish law as recorded in Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat. Here's the first caveat. What's he saying here? He's saying that the borrower, so to speak, has to promise to maintain whatever funds he receives in the utmost carefulness and meticulous manner. If he wants to claim a loss, he has to bring two reliable witnesses who said that the entire time the money was being maintained in a safe, legitimate fashion, which is almost impossible, right? That's point number one. In the event of a financial loss, the burden of proof shall be upon the party of the second part to consist solely of the testimony of two qualified witnesses as stipulated in the previous paragraph. Now, the party of the second part anticipates realization of a net profit of at least 20% per annum of the funds held in this manner after deduction of all expenses, including compensation of the party of the second part for services as agent. However, the declaration of the party of the second part with regard to the extent of the profit or the absence thereof shall be accepted only upon administration of a solemn oath before a rabbinical tribunal. Party of the first part hereby agrees to forgive any and all further claims against the party of the second part upon payment of a sum equal to 10% per annum of the sum transferred in addition to the return of the sum transferred. Very important thing here. What's going on? In other words, the borrower is predicting 20% return. And he's saying the lender is relinquishing all rights to any profit above 10%. And he says to the borrower that in the case that you give me 10%, I don't worry about you having taken oath. You don't have to take an oath. You don't have to provide witnesses. Just give me that and we won't be concerned. Okay? So in other words, the borrower is giving the 10%, not as interest, but in order to get out of the oath, in order to get out of the witnesses, in order to get out of all that. And then the second part agrees to return the funds accepted under this agreement in equal installments, payable on so-and-so of each month in civil calendar. And accounting and payment of any and all profits, as provided in the previous paragraph, shall be made at the same time. And then he goes on to say afterwards that what happens if there's a problem, they should go to a Beis Din, etc., etc. This is an airtight agreement. Mitch, would any bank use it?
No.
Because it's written airtight. That's what's happening here. In other words, what's basically coming down is technically, theoretically, the borrower could get out of paying back the principal, at least the 50%, which specifically the 50%, which is a deposit, on the basis of two witnesses who testify that the whole time he was safeguarding it carefully. He could get out of the payment of the profit by making an oath and saying, there was no, I promise that there was no profit. But the odds are that the person's not going to want to do that. So since the odds are he's not going to do that, therefore the lender gave him an escape hatch and said, you know what? Instead of doing that, all you have to do is give me 10% profit, which is what we anticipated to begin with, were you to have used it properly as an investment, and I'm not going to look at your books. You don't have to worry about it. Okay? So again, the 10% is profit, not interest, given by the borrower in his interest, and because he's interested in getting out of any oath or any testimony. That's Aetherisco. Now, the thing is, there are several questions which involve us after we become aware of the fact there's a heteriska. First of all, can somebody make a general heteriska? In other words, can I say, and this is what the banks in Israel do, they go to the Rabbanut or whoever, and whenever they begin their business, and the Rabbanut writes them a heteriska klali, a general heteriska that any loans made by this bank are going to be in accordance with the halachos of heteriska. A lot of poskim are against it. A lot of poskim say, no, this is, listen, it's a legal loophole. It has to be written for each case specifically. But lemaisa, the way it would be impossible in the modern day business world in Israel to go and write a specific heteriska for each and every customer of the bank every time they came. So therefore, the banks in Israel, which pay obviously interest on bank accounts, and I'm not sure what they do in case of loans, but if it's of the interest on bank accounts is done in the form of heteriska. And all, I guarantee you that every single Jew in Israel of every stripe uses banks. And therefore, everybody relies on the general heteriska. There's no way out of it. Yeah.
But a bank is owned by an individual. Like,
true, a bank is not owned by an individual, but in Israel, they're all owned completely by Jews. In America, there's a way to say, since the corporation is owned by Goyim, or at least most of the stockholders are Goyim, such a bank would be considered to be a Goyish bank, and there's no problem of interest. But is there where the... No, they're owned by Jews. They're privately owned. Yeah. So therefore, it's a problem. Okay? The next point... So Lemaisa, there are some poskim who extend this further, and they say that I can write for myself every year, or for that matter, for the rest of my life, a general heteriska, which is that every loan I make will be on the condition of heteriska. It's just that the guy who's getting the loan has to be aware of the fact that that's been done. You can't just say, well, I made a heteriska, and therefore it's all okay. He also has to agree to the conditions of the heteriska. The next issue is a difficult one. Can you write a heteriska when the government isn't aware of it? In other words, if the government was aware, I don't know if the United States is just viewed as a contract, let's say. But in certain countries, let's say the government would not allow a heteriska. Right? Are you allowed to write it anyway? So it's a big machlokas of poskim. I'm not sure exactly why it works, but there are distinguished poskim who say that, yeah, you're allowed to do it anyway. Even though the government won't allow it, and if they get a hold of this, they'll either throw you in jail or force you to regard it as a loan. Nonetheless, you're allowed to do it. Why? Because it's the contract between the two Jews, which would be enforced by a Beis Din, is one of iska, of business transaction as opposed to loan, therefore they're allowed to do it.
What's the whole problem?
What?
What's the whole
problem? Yeah, dina machus adina, yeah. Yeah. It's a charade, it's not valid, so why should we be allowed to do it? But in America we don't have...
Does dina machus adina answer what's being done under...
In other words, you want to say that it's two distinct things. You might be transgressing dina machus adina, but as far as we're concerned, in terms of this transaction, it's a valid transaction nonetheless. That may be true. That may be the rationale of these poskim. Could be.
That's a problem with banks.
The problem with banks? Well, the thing is, by banks, it's illegal to write a heter iska, or it's just that the banks would be very nervous if the regulators found out.
Normal heter iska is illegal.
It's illegal. So then you have to rely on the Chalkos Yaakov in order to do that. Chalkos Yaakov said...
But if you write it, it's just an illegal contract. You get thrown in jail.
What? Right, so you have to rely on what Rabbi Noble is saying, what the Chalkos Yaakov says, that despite the fact that if the government found out, you get thrown in jail and it's illegal, nonetheless, since it's a contract between two Jews, which is binding in Jewish law, therefore it's valid. The question is also, does a verbal heter iska work? Now, the thing is, in all sources which we find a heter iska mentioned, it's written. It's a document. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch brings down, and you have your photocopy, although I'm not going inside with it, you have a photocopy of the whole siman in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which has to do with Heter Iska, including his version of Heter Iska. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says, B'shas Adchak, if you're stuck and you have to transact the loan and you don't have any document with you, you can make an oral Heter Iska. In other words, I can say to you, listen, I need $100 fast, I'll pay you back $100 plus $10 based on the Heter Iska, which is in Contemporary Halachic Problems, pages 386 to 388. Okay? So in that case, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says it works. Other poskim say it doesn't work. They say anytime you want to use a legal loophole, it's got to be written. And they try and bring a proof from a Gemara Ksuva. Of course, we all know women, a woman is promised 200 zuz in her Ksuva. The Gemara talks about a case where a woman writes a receipt for her husband. I don't know why a woman would want to marry a husband like this, but she writes a receipt for her husband that she got 100, she already got 100 zuz of her ksuva. So there is an opinion there of one of the Rishonim that is only valid if she wrote it down, not if she verbally specified it. Because verbal specification is not as binding in halacha as writing, because we have a principle in halacha called asmachta. Things which are verbally agreed upon are sometimes considered to be just idle chatter and not binding halacha. Therefore, certain things in halacha must be written, a transaction must be formally done in order to actually make it legal. So that Rishon wants to say that that's the case by the case of a receipt on a ksuva. The woman didn't receive anything. She's just doing it in order to placate her husband. In that case, she has to write it down, otherwise it's not valid. The same thing would apply here, according to those opinions, that one cannot make a verbal heter iska. Lemais, however, most poskim say that since this loophole has become institutionalized, it's not just an isolated case, like a woman who's being moichel, who's forgiving $100 of her ksuva. This is a loophole which has been formalized through the generations and is well accepted. Therefore, it's not considered to be detrimental in the contract if it's done verbally, at least where one doesn't have the potential, the possibility at that time of writing a document.
How was the note originally written? I mean, even if you say that you write something, and you say according to the Heter Iska filed in
Bleich, yes.
How is it, what does the note say? Doesn't the note contradict what the Heter Iska
is? The note.
You have to say, Chaim borrowed from Ruvain.
Yeah, you can't use the word borrowed. You have to say Chaim took $100 from Ruvain on the basis of a Heter Iska.
To be paid back
on the basis of Heter Iska. You can't use the word borrowed anywhere in the document, except in regard to that 50%, which is actually a loan.
Yeah, but once you start the 50%, you're writing out the whole contract.
No, so don't write down anything. Write down, all you have to write is Chaim borrowed from Ruvain $100 on the basis of... Chaim took from Ruvain $100 on the basis of the Heter Iska and Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 2, etc., and promises to return or accepts upon himself the return of so and so much percentage profit a year. Okay? So that way, you don't take it as borrowed, term it duk. You don't term it as interest, you term it as profit. And that way you get around the whole problem. But the thing is like this. What about loans that everybody knows are personal? You asked before, what about a loan I take up from a bank in order to go to a trip to, hopefully not Las Vegas, let's say a trip to Israel, right? You take out a loan from a bank, and everybody knows that you're not doing it in order to, everybody knows you're not doing it in order to invest, right? I take a loan from you because I want to go buy a newspaper, and I promise you I'll give you a few cents interest. Everybody knows I'm not investing that. Is it possible in such case to write a heter iska? That's not commercial. Who are we fooling? Rav Moshe Feinstein says, you know, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch also says a similar thing. You can take a look at it. It's on page, on this handout, it's on page 5. In Sif Yud, in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Shtar Iska lo mahani lahati, Shtar Iska doesn't work to allow Elima Emes Kein Hu unless this is the truth. That he's taking the money in order to make business. If he's not taking the money in order to make business, but just to pay off some debt, you know, credit card debt or something like that, take a trip to Israel. Doesn't work. Because it's a lie. It's all a bunch of baloney. Ramosha says, one of his troops says, people have to realize heter iska is not mumbo jumbo incantation. It's not magic. There's no magic in halacha. A heter iska has to be bona fide money given for the purpose of commercial investment. In that case, it's okay. But Rav Moshe is very much against giving personal loans on the basis of a heter iska. So tshuva, which he wrote to a Jewish bank, he was not happy with the idea of giving heter iska for a personal loan because the whole thing is a farce. It's a lie. So how do people get around it? Obviously, heter iskas are used all the time for personal loans.
What did Rav Moshe say?
He didn't.
Well, he said not to do it.
He said not to do it. So how do people get around it? So there are a couple of poskim will speak about it. The Maharsham. The Maharsham was Reb Sholem Shvadron. It was a posik at the beginning, the grandfather, the president of Reb Sholem Shvadron, great-grandfather, I think. President of Reb Sholem Shvadron was a big posik around the turn of the century. He writes, listen, what the guy who gets the money does with the loan actually is his personal business. We look at the document. You know, I put blinders on ourselves. It says in the document that it's a commercial venture. It's a commercial venture. If the guy who got the money then takes the money, uses it for his personal interests, okay, that's his problem. As far as the document is concerned, he took the money for the commercial venture. And that's why he has to, in order to get out of the testimony requirement, in order to get out of the oath requirement, he's got to provide us with the profit of 10% or whatever it was per annum. So what's happening, according to Shoyal Meshiv, to Maharsham, is even though we know that he's taking the money for his personal use, nonetheless, since the document says it's being for commercial investment, sufficient. Yeah.
Does that mean the person who's taking the loan is in violation?
The person who's taking the loan is in violation of a promise to use it for commercial.
They're in violation.
No. They're not a violation of usury because he's violating the terms of his contract. But that doesn't concern us. In other words, you're right. If it wasn't written in the document that it's a commercial venture, so then he'd be in violation of usury. But now that it's written in the document that it's a commercial venture, so on the contrary, he's a breach of contract. But he can get out of the breach of contract. I, the lender, won't sue him for breach of contract as long as he pays me the profit. I won't be concerned. So he's paying now the money, not as interest, but in order to avoid the lawsuit or breach of contract. And that's considered, again, to be utilizing the loophole of not paying interest, but paying profit. Or paying to get out of a problem of taking an oath, or a problem of bringing witnesses. That's one interpretation, one approach. The Sholem Meshiv, Rabbi Yosef Shol Natanson, who was a big posik in the middle of the previous century, the rabbi of Lemberg, now Lvov, right, so he has another logic to say it's permissible. He says, you know why it's permissible? Because in essence, any loan, let's say even I take a loan to take a trip to Israel. So in essence, I'm taking this loan in order to facilitate my livelihood. Whether it's facilitating my livelihood by procuring funds, which otherwise I would have had to take from my food money, or it's securing my livelihood because a trip to Israel is beneficial to my health, or for whatever other reason, in essence, the loan is allowing me to live a full and productive life, no matter what I use the money for. This is especially applicable in case of a student loan, right? If I take a student loan in order to achieve an education, in order that I should be able eventually to make a living, so that too follows the same parameters. As a result of this loan, I'm enabled to lead a more productive life. That in and of itself is a commercial venture. The fact that now I'm enabled to lead a more productive and fruitful life and engage in my livelihood is a commercial venture, and therefore the conditions of the contract are being met. So even if it's a personal loan, since ultimately it helps me in my parnosa, that's okay. Stretching a little bit in terms of a trip, a pleasure trip, but one would have to configure it in somehow. Finally, there's a third approach, which is the approach of Moshe Sternbuch, a contemporary posek, who wrote a sefer called Mo'adim Uzmanim, which says, in our day and age, we know that many people invest in the stock market. That's everybody. So therefore, even if a loan is given on a personal basis, it's very likely that that money, or money which corresponds to that amount, will be invested by the borrower, so to speak, in the stock market, and will be used in the end result for a commercial venture. So even though it's a personal loan, since it's a very good likelihood that it's going to be used, for a commercial purpose, that's why I can go ahead and do it and write a heter iska in that situation. Okay? Why are you smiling?
I don't know if many people do it.
Anyway, that's the logic which he uses. Now we come to a completely different problem, which is a very, very difficult problem. The problem of mortgage loans. And let's take a look and read what Rabbi Bleich says here on the bottom of page 5. This is a very difficult problem, and there's no satisfactory solution.
Why don't we use the Marsham Sholmeshev?
What?
Why don't you use their logic?
Well, let's see. A mortgage loan in which the seller accepts a purchase mortgage representing all or part of the purchase price does not lend itself to use of a usual heter iska. Since no cash, now Mitch, I don't know if you, maybe you disagree with the actual what he says here, but he says, since no cash is actually advanced by the seller to the purchaser has no opportunity to realize a profit from the investment of such funds. Is that true? The cash doesn't go from the seller to the purchaser?
What cash would there be from the seller to the purchaser?
Checks with which he uses to pay for the house.
This purchaser pays the seller, not the...
What?
The purchaser.
Does the bank give the money of the loan to the purchaser, or does it give the money to the seller of the property? To the purchase of the property. Okay, so what he's saying is not, he didn't perceive it like that. He says, since no cash is actually advanced by the seller, or in this case, the bank, to the purchaser has no opportunity to realize the profit from the investment of such funds. You know, he might mean something else. Now I realize what he's saying. Here he means that the seller is financing the mortgage. Does that happen often?
Yeah,
so here's something about something else. Now I realize what was my mistake. It's not talking about where the bank is giving the purchaser money to buy the house. It's talking about where the seller is financing the purchase by the purchaser. And in that case, what's happening is the seller, let's say you're selling a house, Reuven is selling a house to Shimon. And Shimon can't afford to pay all the money at once. So Reuven says to Shimon, you know what, I'll provide you with a mortgage. Instead of you going to a bank and getting $100,000 from them, you will owe me this $100,000 and you'll pay interest to me over time. This is a problem. Because here, Reuven is not, who's the seller, who's the purchaser. But the seller is not providing the purchaser with any actual money. Where the seller provides the purchaser, where the lender provides the borrower with money. So I say, oh, you know what? The money becomes a heter iska. Money becomes money given for purpose of a commercial investment, not for purpose of personal use. But here there's no money. Nothing exchanged hands. The seller financed it without giving any money to the purchaser. So what money did the purchaser get, which allegedly he can use to invest? None. So how is it going to work? That's what he says. Let's go on. Let's read a little bit further. According to the seller, has no reason to demand an oath to the effect and no right to accept the stipulated sum in lieu of an oath. Of course, if it may be reasonably anticipated that a market value of the real estate will rise, a partnership agreement might be drafted which would provide for a specified rate of return in lieu of payment of a partnership share of the actual increment in value. However, in the event that the value of the real estate does not rise and no profit is realized, acceptance of interest in lieu of profits poses a halachic problem. It may be argued that if real estate values are a matter of common knowledge, there is really no basis to demand an oath to that effect, and hence no right to accept monetary payment in lieu of an oath. So, in this case, Rabbi Bly came up with two suggestions, each of which is not going to be particularly pleasant for the people involved. One suggestion is that the interest which the purchaser pays to the seller should all be viewed as rent money. Now, rent money. In other words, until the mortgage is all paid up, so really the title belongs to the seller. And all the money which the purchaser is paying towards that is considered to be rent money. Which, of course, is obviously going to present problems because, obviously, in these cases, for many reasons, the person who sold the house doesn't want to be the title holder and landlord of the buyer for 30 years. You know? What? The seller holds it for 30 years? No. Not the title. He doesn't own the house for those 30 years.
So the buyer wouldn't want it either.
What?
The buyer doesn't want it either.
No, the buyer doesn't want it either, right. He wants to own the house. Yeah, he doesn't want to be the tenant. That's right. Neither of the people are going to want it in this case. What? The seller can foreclose in that case? No, but there are other different things like tax responsibilities and all that kind of stuff, which is going to be a problem. Yeah, well, you're right, but it's going to complicate matters very dramatically. That's the point involved. No, it's not going to be a conventional type of mortgage. Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. 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 That may be true, but in this case, he won't be able to sell whatsoever because he doesn't have any title, because he's just a renter for those 30 years.
Not legally, though.
Well, if it's not legally, but that's the point. You have to make a legal contract here, which is going to change the whole nature of it. So I'm just doing that briefly because I want to get to one other point before I finish. But you have all of it written in here if you want to go through it. The other approach which he has is some sort of more complicated thing, which I don't fully understand, which is that... Now I remember. Now they look at the board. Another problem with that is talking foreclosing. The way Rabbi Black wants to set it up is that over time, the amount of rent paid will gradually increase the amount of title which the buyer gets. In other words, over time, the more rent which is paid, the more it accrues. So now you can't foreclose. Now you can't foreclose on him. Because if he has equity, if he has all that equity in the house, so when you sell the house, you're going to have to give him a share of whatever you realize. Right? All right, but let's not get into this. Most of us will not be in this situation. Another problem which he has, he has another solution, some sort of other contract which he made up, and it takes pages and pages in this book in order to go through. And if you ever come to such a situation, you can refer to this place and use that contract. But I want to take a look at you at a very interesting Heter Iska here. On, like I said, on page 7 and 8, you have the Heter Iskas, which are used in various different situations. And I want to tell you the ones on page 8 are not particularly good. Rabbi Noble already remarked before that the ones on page 8, which we read, has a whole mishmash about who's taking the oath, what the witness is testifying to. It's very unclear. The one on the other side of page 8, on the right-hand side, is much worse. It's completely unclear. Okay? The one on page 7 is an interesting one. The one on page 7 is a very good Shtei Heter Iska. It goes through all the things, much shorter than Rabbi Black's, but basically it goes through all the major stipulations. Then, however, at the end of the Heter Iska, you have this agreement is enforceable solely in an Orthodox Jewish religious court, impaneled pursuant to the requirements of Orthodox Jewish law. Any such decision rendered by the Beis Din shall not be enforceable in a secular civil court in any manner whatsoever. This agreement is not enforceable, nor may be adjudicated or submitted for any purpose before any adjudicatory body, including but not limited to civil courts, criminal courts, or regulatory agencies. Now, what you see is a very interesting thing here. Basically, what's happening is that the bank is retaining the right legally to ignore the heter iska. In other words, they're willing to submit to a heter iska as adjudicated by a beis din. But they're retaining the right in civil law to ignore the beis din and go over the beis din's head to a civil court. And if at the stage where they get to a civil court, at that point, they're going to say, well, the heter iska is null and void. So therefore, if in fact somebody ever came to the bank and said, you know what, I'm willing to go get two witnesses. I'm willing to take the oath in front of the presence of an Orthodox rabbi, his congregation, and rabbinical courts. I'm willing to do all this in order to prove that I didn't make any profits. So then the bank says, okay, tough luck. Now we're going to go to civil court, and in civil court, you won't be able to hold us to the heter iska. Hi, they're Jews, and they're committed to the heter iska. Basically, what they did is they retained the right to be rishoyim. So, in this case, civilly to be rishoyim. So in this case, it's going to depend, but pashtus on what we said before, on the Chalkas Yaakov. Because in this case, if you look at it technically, so that's the question here. I don't have a resolution to this, and I understand that it's a machlokas haposkim whether this is valid or not. But you can look at it theoretically. Listen, this is a contract between two Jews. I'm a Jew. The bank is a Jew. We're talking about a Jewish bank here. I'm a Jew. The bank is a Jew. So where else are we going to go if not to Beis Din? Well, would you think that as two Jews we would go to their coast where we go to the civil courts? Chlishim b'ksherim. We would never do something like that. On the other hand, that's one way of looking at it. And in that case, you would say it's valid. Just like Chalkos Yaakov said, that something which the government would go protest against, but which we two contract as two Jews, is valid. So same thing here. You would say, true, I left myself the loophole of being a Russia on going over the head of the basin to a civil court, but we're two Jews, so of course we're never going to come to such a thing. We're just going to remain in front of basin. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is, like you said, to say that such a clause in the document itself makes it clear that the bank is out to contravene halacha. And since the bank is out to contravene halacha, so it would not be valid. So I understand that this is a machlokas haposkim, and that there are poskim who say that this is good, and there are poskim who say that this is not good, and ask your local rabbi before you enter into such an agreement.
I just want to amend one thing.
Yeah. Wait.
The clause is not done to contravene halacha. It's done because without this, it's an illegal document. The bank cannot sign it. So just like someone would ask the bank to sign this without the paragraph, they're asking the bank to do something illegal. If the bank asks someone not to have a heter iska, so the bank is asking someone to do something illegal halachically. So what this does is makes it permissible legally for banks to do it. So not the contravening.
That puts a better shade on it.
Yes.
That puts a better shade on it. Okay.